My name is Mpho Chitapi, and this is TCS Plus, the business and technology show which shines a spotlight on the thinkers, builders, and innovators shaping industry. I'm joined in studio today by Michael Rousseau. Michael, welcome. How are you today?
Very well, thanks. Pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you, and we have a very exciting topic today. It's called It's Your Money. Take back control of your pension savings from a previous employer. So we'll be talking all things retirement, preservation funds, pension funds, that kind of stuff. But before we get into it, Michael, I really would just like to know a bit about you. Who is Michael? What do you do? What makes you tick? That kind of thing.
Sure. Well, I've specialized in post-retirement and retirement savings for the past decade. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was actually checking the other day in terms of how many investors I've actually spoken to, and I'm surprised it was about 14,000 investors. Mm-hmm. And then I personally consult on about 4 to 5, it fluctuates, mm-hmm. Billion assets under management. So it's very rewarding role to be in because you just get to help people, mm-hmm. As well as actually have like a number to it. So mm-hmm. The beauty about my job is you can actually see, oh, this is the positive impact that I've had, and you can work it out. Not to sound too cheesy, but it's nice to be able to quantify your social impact on the community and that. So yeah, and I basically just help investors with their investments and that.
Awesome. Lots of big numbers there. Sounds very exciting what you do.
Lands up being just another zero.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's dive right into it. So changing jobs, it can be a very exciting time. But one thing that people tend to overlook when making this big decision is what actually happens to their pension money when they start something new. So let's start with the basics. In South Africa, what usually happens to your pension when you leave your company?
Yeah, I think to answer that question, you actually have to have quite a bit of an understanding of what exactly are retirement funds, like what is their purpose, how do they work, that kind of thing. So a lot of people hear these words, you know, provident fund, pension fund, retirement annuities. These are all just investment vehicles that you actually land up using to achieve a certain goal. Mm-hmm. So more examples of it would be like unit trusts, tax-free savings accounts, endowments, share portfolios. You hear all these words. And the thing about these investment vehicles is each of them have pros and cons. So if you say a retirement fund, like a retirement annuity compared to a unit trust. Mm-hmm. If you invest in a unit trust, there's no limit in terms of how much you can invest. The money gets invested in a specific fund, and it grows according to the market. And you have the pro would be you have 100% access to those funds. But the drawback would be the growth is taxable. Mm. So and then you compare that to, let's say, like a retirement annuity, where you can contribute towards it and then SARS gives you a tax return. Mm-hmm. The growth is tax-free. So you're able to actually grow your money faster inside of a retirement annuity because you get to keep more of your returns. But the drawback, you can't just access your money. You can't pull out 100% of it. So when you sort of trying to achieve certain investment goals, you need to weigh up the pros and cons of each of these investment vehicles and figure out a balance of, okay, I'm going to put this towards that goal and this towards that goal. So that's where provident pension and retirement annuities kind of fit in. You use these retirement vehicles to save for retirement because it's going to give you tax return, tax-free growth. And it just helps you for the long term. The problem is when you sort of moving through the workspace, you as an individual, I often hear this where people will say my pension fund and my provident fund. If I'm being hyper technical, this actually doesn't make a lot of sense to me because you as an individual, you're not allowed to have a pension or a provident fund.
Sure.
Only a company can open up a pension provident fund. You can be a member of the pension provident fund and save inside of the companies. So it's not actually yours.
Never thought about it like that before.
Exactly, yeah. And then you have a retirement annuity where you as an individual can use it to save for retirement. So this is why I kind of wanted to just take one step back, because by understanding that part, now you see why a lot of people preserve their money outside. So you can leave your money inside of the pension or the problem. So when you leave a company, you can leave it in the fund, right? That is an option. Or you can actually move it out into a preservation fund under your name as an individual, rather than leaving it under the company's name in their pension provident fund. So it's sort of just taking a little bit more control of your own, you know, savings.
Yes.
And the nice thing about a preservation fund is, what you'll find is many investors, they'll move from like company to company. So they'll go company A in their pension fund, save. Then they'll leave, move that into a preservation fund. Then they'll join company B, save towards their pension fund. And then in 5 years' time when they leave them, then they transfer that into a preservation fund. And then they and. And they just use it as a base to accumulate their savings. So that's sort of the role and the purpose of preservation funds and how they kind of fit in with, you know, when you're moving jobs.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sure, the penny really dropped for me, because I had never thought about it like that before. You know, we just have this conception that it is my money and somebody's managing it for me, but it's just, you know. So the way that you've put it is really something. And let's talk about the category of people that choose to just leave a company and never look back at what happens to their funds.
I do every now and then come into contact with investors that completely forget that their money is with a company that they were with. They'll move on, and because they don't have it under their name and it's under the company's name, they sometimes completely forget about it. So, and then you move on 20 years, and I get this call from an investor. I'm not even lying. This happened on Thursday, where a client just called and said, I worked for a company 20 years ago and now I'm struggling to locate my money. And he's given them their details and that, and now they're trying to look for it. It just makes life a little bit complicated, whereas preservation fund does tend to make your life a lot simpler, because it's you, it's an account linked to your name and you can continuously monitor it. The when it comes to leaving a company, you have a couple options. You can either leave it in fund, you can move it into a preservation fund, you can move it into a retirement annuity, and you can cash out. So there's four roads that you can take.
Okay.
And sometimes you can do a partial cash out and then one of these options, right? So there's pros and cons to each option. So leaving it in fund, depending on the pension provident rules, each, some of them have their own unique rules that has benefits linked to it and all that. So you just want to make sure before you leave, do you still retain those benefits if you leave the company, or do you forfeit it? Because that can sort of decide if you leave or not. The nice thing is you don't have to go through numerous amounts of paperwork or research in terms of choosing a preservation fund or retirement annuity. And but as I mentioned, it stays under the control of the company. So the drawback would be you would have – a lot of them tend to have limited investment options. So by moving it to a preservation fund, you can move it to a preservation fund with 100 different investment companies, with 100 different investment choices. So you do tend to have a lot more option when it comes to investing by shifting it to a preservation fund, where it's limited with a pension provident fund. You tend to, like, the company chooses the company that they want to invest with, and you have to go with that, right? Sometimes I've seen some, you know, pension provident funds where the fees are really high. So you just want to also double check that and see, right, what am I paying on a monthly basis? Usually they are pension provident funds. They tend to be low cost. Every now and then I see quite high fees, and then you can actually improve your situation by actually moving to a preservation fund and lowering your fees. Then you moving on to your second and third option, which would be preservation fund and retirement annuity. So preservation fund versus retirement annuity, that's a tricky one because us human beings, we sometimes suffer from mental accounting. So what do I mean by that? Say now you have a provident fund, okay? And you now want to decide, move it to a preservation fund or a retirement annuity. If you move it to a preservation fund, the reason why it's called a preservation fund is because it preserves the access benefits that come with the provident fund. So it's not because it preserves the capital. It's a common misconception there. Okay. So the reason why it's called a preservation fund is to preserve the access benefits that you have to the provident fund that you don't have in a retirement annuity. Mm-hmm. So if you've got, let's say, you know, R1 million saved up, and you were to move it into a retirement annuity, which you can do, unfortunately, your access to that capital amount actually is very much so. Whereas if you moved it into the Provident Preservation Fund, you get to retain the access benefits that come with that vested pot. The only unfortunate thing is, and this is a common scenario where you'll leave one company and move to another where it had a pension provident fund, but the new one doesn't.
Okay.
So you want to continue saving towards retirement.
Absolutely.
But you have this retirement savings, so you move it to a provident preservation fund, but you can't contribute towards it on a monthly basis.
Okay.
You can only transfer what you've already saved into it. So then a lot of people look at retirement annuities and they go, okay, I can transfer this into a retirement annuity and I can contribute on a monthly basis and I can keep it all nicely together. But the problem,
you can't access it.
Exactly. And I've seen over the years, life sometimes happens and you need access to a large capital amount. And if you put it into the RA, you've gone and forfeited that. So you have a bit of a catch 22. So the optimal route actually is to transfer the R1 million in this example to a provident preservation fund to preserve the access benefits and then start a retirement annuity concurrently with it and contribute towards that on a monthly basis.
So what I'm getting is it's very important to understand the different vehicles, what the restrictions are, and also what your own appetite is for investing, right? Because like you said, with an older employer, you have no control over what that money stays invested in. But if you were to move it across, you might exercise a bit more of autonomy around that.
Oh, spot on. Yeah. I mean, that's the point, is trying to take control of your money. As you can see, it starts to get a bit complicated, and that's why it's so important to know these things. I mean, that's why we're doing this kind of thing. It's just so that people know and they're aware of their options, because sometimes you can make a decision that lands up sort of restricting you, like moving everything into a retirement annuity. I've been doing this for a long time, and I can tell you now immediately when I say, okay, this is the optimal answer, two things come to mind. The first one is, if the money's split, is it going to grow less, right? And the answer is actually no. If you invest in the exact same funds in both, it's going to grow the exact same rate as if it was all in one. So no difference in returns there. And then another question that I get is, okay, but now I've got two accounts and I know the investment industry. Am I now paying double the fees now? So are you trying to get me to open a second account? And again, well, I'm going to answer this in 10X's name. No, the fees are very similar as if you were to put it all in one. Sometimes it's actually more cost effective to actually split it up, depending on your scenario. Ultimately, the optimal sort of solution in that case, if you want to preserve and contribute, would be to have these two vehicles running together. And then the final option, which is often where there's a lot of, you know, stigma around, it's the cash out option.
I want to get to that, right? And with when you've just left a job, you sort of have this thing that things are going to get better. And so you think, oh, if I, you know, dip in a little bit, I'll be able to pay it back. Lifestyle creep sets in, you know, you might be escalating your monthly living expenses. And it seems fairly innocent to say, oh, let me just cash out a little bit, I'll make it up. What are your thoughts on people who change jobs and put a down payment on a German car?
Yeah. So I'm actually going to share a personal story, right? Because a lot of people are sort of made to feel guilty of cashing out. Right? But remember, the whole point of retirement savings is to live, is to save for the future.
Yes.
But remember, you have to be able to get past today as well, or tomorrow. So I don't want people to feel too guilty about cashing out, if it's for the right reasons, right? In terms of getting through the next couple months. Because often when people are leaving jobs, sometimes it's a retrenchment, you know? And now you don't have an income and you have responsibilities and bills to pay. So I'm not going to just sit here and go, no, don't cash out. No, because that's not realistic. In my personal situation, so I made the mistake of cashing out when I was a lot younger. In that instance, when I evaluated the decision to cash out a little bit or not, I understood the long-term ramifications and compared it to the short-term. And I had a student loan that had a very high interest rate that my retirement savings was going to struggle to actually beat. So you make the decision going, okay, I know I have this money and this is saved across, but by, taking this money, squashing this bad debt and then taking the cash flow that I've just freed up and contributing towards it to catch up, I felt in that situation after doing the sums, it's going to be better off.
Yes.
So there are situations where cashing out could be a good decision, whether it's an adverse one or you running the numbers and that. So I don't want to just sit here and go, no, bad to cash out. But again, understanding the long-term consequences of cashing out is important. And that's why I made that decision and why I felt very informed to make that call. Okay. A lot of the time you'll find that sometimes people will cash out and not actually understand the long-term consequences. So what are those consequences?
What are some of those consequences in the shorter term and in the longer term?
Nailed it. Exactly. So there's short-term and long-term consequences. So the short-term, everyone knows, you get taxed, right? So first 25K, you're going to get whacked. It's going to be tax-free. But then the next up to 660, 18%, above that 27, and then up until a point 36. So that tax table starts to get more and more aggressive and starts to hurt a lot more in terms of how much you cashing out, right? So the short-term consequence, you are basically taking a portion of your hard-earned money that you've saved and invested, and now you're giving it away to SARS. Instead of keeping it for yourself for the future. So that's the short-term. The long-term ramifications is the compounding loss. So if you're taking, let's say, 200K out now, that's not just 200K now. That 200K is going to compound, depending on how old you are, for many years, and it's actually going to accumulate to quite a substantial amount. And that number is something that you want to work out and say, right, how much am I actually taking away from my retirement savings? And the moment you project that number forward, you start to realize, oh, this is actually a serious number. It's bigger than I thought it was. Another consequence that is not common knowledge, when you get to retirement stage, everybody's entitled to a tax-free portion of 550,000 rand.
Okay.
So in other words, you've saved up all your life now, you get to retirement, and now SARS says, okay, we want to allow you to take some money out, 550,000.
That's the limit at the moment.
Yes.
Okay.
Tax-free. And we want you to use that for an emergency fund, just in case something happens, so that you have liquidity, because the when you retire and you move your funds into a post-retirement vehicle, those vehicles are fairly rigid when it comes to income. So you can't just say, okay, I need 100K and pull out. That's not how those two options or vehicles work. So they're extremely limited in terms of how you can pull money out of that retirement savings. So that's where your flexibility can come from, is that 550K.
Mm.
Now, the reason why cashing out is a problem when it comes to this 550K is it's a lifetime amount, and any previous withdrawals that you've made reduces that 550K.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a double hit. You pay tax to SARS, so you've lost that money, you've lost the compounding effect, and you've lost out on that 550K tax-free portion.
So you're not doing your future self any favors
by doing that.
Okay.
So you really have to consider, right, is the short-term worth the sacrificing the long-term or not?
Mm.
And everybody's going to have a different scenario and a different situation, and you need to weigh that up. Mm. So cashing out, it tends to be a spicy topic.
Very spicy. And there's this, you know, striking idea that when you cash out in your 30s, you can actually lose up to half your pension.
Mm.
That is a really tough pill to swallow. Because I think when you're in your 30s, like I said, you feel like you're really just getting into your career and things will get better. But once you make that initial loss, I think time is the important thing, right? Is that those initial years, once you've lost them, you can't really get them back.
Yeah, I mean, that's a compounding effect that I was talking about. And the thing is, I found that there's different, there's three levels of knowledge when it comes to the compounding effect, right? Mm-hmm. The knowledge is, okay, you've heard of it, but you don't know what it is.
Yes.
Then the second layer is you've heard of it and you know what it is, but there isn't a deep understanding of actually like what exactly it is. And then there's the third level where is, I know it, I've heard of it, and now I actually understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And you chat to anybody like a 40, 50, 60-year-old that has gone through the compounding effect, they have a very deep understanding. So it's very difficult for young people to actually comprehend the power of compounding. And just to illustrate, this is my favorite example.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to compounding, it's Jack and Jill.
Okay.
So two twins, Jack and Jill, they're both saving towards retirement. The one starts saving 1,000 rand a month from age 20 to 30, right? Mm-hmm. Jill only starts at age 30, but Jack stops. So Jack goes from age 20 to 30,000 rand a month and then stops at age 30.
Okay.
Jill starts at age 30, saves 1,000 rand a month all the way to age 60. Who has more money?
I'm going to think Jill, because even though she's a little late to the party, you know, she's done it for longer.
You'd think that, but Jack's money has been compounding for a lot longer.
Mm.
And that's where he lands up having a lot more money than Jill.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just trying to help people understand the power of compounding is Jill contributed three times more, but Jack actually landed up having more money at the end of the day just because he started sooner. Because he left his money there and he didn't pull it out, you know. And
that's why they call it the eighth wonder of the world.
Yeah. And I think retirement savings, you'll find like, let's say, I'm going to use a random number here. Let's say you have, I don't know, 10 million rand at retirement. You've been saving very well, right?
Mm-hmm.
You get 10 million rand at retirement. And if you look at, okay, how much of that did I land up contributing to? How much was the market and how much did SARS give me?
Mm-hmm.
Because remember, when you contribute towards retirement savings, you actually get a tax return back that you can also invest in.
Mm-hmm.
So this is why people use retirement savings, is because instead of it's just you contributing towards it with your hard-earned cash and market, SARS also comes to the party. And what you'll find is if you start early and you want to save to 10 million, let's say in your 20s, 30s, you only had to contribute like a million rand or so. The rest came from the market and SARS.
Mm.
So you outsourced a lot of that saving.
Mm.
But if you start in your 40s or 50s, unfortunately, you would have to come up with like 5-6 more of that, and then the market would come up with the rest. If you start even later than that, I mean, you can see you basically putting a lot more responsibility on yourself to come up with that total amount that you need.
Absolutely.
So that's why it's so important to try and start early. So.
Definitely, yeah. As the sooner the better.
Yeah.
And yeah, this notion that I'll just do it later, I'll get to it. You don't have as much time as you think, unfortunately. And let's assume, Jill, I'll carry on with the Jill example. Jill manages to leave her employer. There's no emergencies. There's no reckless spending. She still has her pension or a provident fund intact. What should she now be doing? What is the blueprint of, you know, what a model citizen should should do when leaving a job? What would you say is the right thing there?
Well, to make it simple for people, I think you can sort of summarize it into three steps.
Mm.
Step one is understanding the different investment vehicles. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what we've been discussing mm-hmm. up until so far, right?
Mm-hmm.
Understanding the investment vehicles, what the options, which one's going to work best for you.
Mm.
Then the second step is now, once you've decided, okay, which vehicle is best to use to preserve a retirement annuity and then other investment vehicles, you move on to step two, which is, okay, so another thing that a technical term, I sometimes hear people say my retirement annuity isn't performing, right?
Mm.
Again, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me, if I'm being hyper-technical, right? Because a retirement annuity or unit trust, they are empty vehicles.
Mm.
They don't perform or underperform. It's actually the fund or the portfolio that you put inside of the vehicle that performs or underperforms. So that fund, that would be like cash, bonds, property, shares, both local and abroad. So you can have, let's say, three unit trusts. Just the one is invested only in cash, the one is only in bonds, and the one is only in shares, right? And they're all going to perform at different levels. But they're all three still unit trusts.
Mm.
So it's not necessarily the vehicle that performs or underperforms. It's actually what's inside.
Yes.
So that step two, asset allocation, where it gets invested, that would be the next step. And then the third and final step would be fees, right?
Mm.
So you can do step one and two perfectly, only for everything to come undone through high fees. So
fees are very daunting, I must say, because we don't really understand how they work. We don't really know what they should be. I don't think that information is always readily available. And I've heard of something called the EAC.
Mm.
What is that? How would I go about knowing what that is? And then, you know, when I shop around or when I'm doing my own research to say, okay, this is the correct number.
Yeah. So, again, the reason why I mentioned in the beginning of how many investors I've spoken to, right, is just to validate what I'm saying, because I've seen it all.
Mm.
By speaking to so many people, you have such a large sample set that you can actually speak towards what the population, what South Africans are actually doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say about 90% of investors that I speak to have no idea what their fees are.
Sure.
Like, none. A portion of that 90% think they know. And sometimes they speak with great authority to me saying, no, I know this is my fee. And unfortunately, they just got caught out by our investment industry. So our investment industry it's quite renowned for struggling with full disclosure when it comes to fees. So how does an investor protect themselves from this? And the best way is to ask for EAC, which stands for effective annual cost.
Mm.
So when you ask for effective annual cost, it's a legal obligation to the representative that you're talking to disclose it in a table format.
Okay.
And this table encapsulates all the different layers of fees that you are going to land up paying, as well as the benefits that come with that. Because sometimes there are certain benefits that are a pro, right? Weighed up against the fees, it actually reduces the net cost. So when you're asking for EAC, that is conclusive, right? So What that means is it includes, and I'm going to just ring them off just so that everyone knows, all right, tech, because I'll say EAC, say that it's all inclusive. This is what you mean by total fees. And then they'll still come back to me in the same sentence asking, okay, but what is there any upfront fees? Is there any this fee? So EAC includes upfront costs. It includes ongoing financial advisor fees. It includes administration, platform fees, other fees, access fees. Then you get to the fund level where it includes total expense ratio, TIC, trading costs, performance fees, and there are many layers of fees involved that you could be paying. So instead of trying to ask for each itemized billing and potentially missing one that you didn't know about, asking for EAC is going to give you that number, and it's not just going to give you one number. It's going to give it to you over 1, 3, 5, 10, 20 years.
Okay.
So you can see, and then you start to see, all right, this provider's either front-loading the fees or back-loading. You can interpret that that table. The problem is EAC is half the job done. So
Only half the job. It already sounds so technical.
I know. So don't ask for itemized billing. Save yourself some time. Ask for EAC. You receive the number. Now you need to interpret it.
Yes.
And again,
that was going to be my next question because I was going to ask, can I run it through my ChatGPT? Because I don't know what these numbers mean.
Let's park the AI question to maybe at the end, because it's something that I'm starting to interact with a lot more with clients, and it's been so fascinating to see how things have started to differ in the approach. But yeah, coming back to the fees, when you ask for EAC, you're going to get your number, right? So you're going to have to interpret that number. Now, a lot of investors, this is not their job. They don't know, is this a low, medium, high fee? What are we talking? So through talking to so many people, they share their statements, their quotes, and you start to get a firm grasp of the industry and the fees that they offer, right? So instead of you having to talk to so many people, I'm just going to share it with you. So a low fee tends to be around the 1% mark and less, right? So that's on the low side. Your medium cost, 1 to 2%, that's your medium EAC. And then you have your high-cost providers, which are 2% and more, right? I want to caveat that just to be very fair, right? On the rare occasion, you do have providers that actually charge more than 2% fee, and they give you so much more return that they justify it, right?
Okay.
But again, I want to caveat that with it's on the rare occasion. So you have to be very careful when you're signing a high fee, because returns aren't guaranteed, but the fees are. So very important to constantly evaluate if you do have a high fee structure, and you need to be able to monitor performance to make sure that you are paying a fair fee. So yeah, so the one on the one side, knowing how to ask for fees, EAC. On the other side, knowing is this a low, medium, high fee, right? That will give you an idea. So why is this a low, medium, or high fee, right? And we spoke about how returns compound, right? And how it's the eighth, you know, wonder of the world. But nobody ever talks to you about how fees also compound, but negatively. So it's also a percentage, just like your returns. So if the returns are compounding, surely the fees are compounding as well. And that's where things start to get really scary, because when the person says, oh, 1.5% fee, doesn't sound like much, right? But over a long period of time, that 1.5, I mean, without compounding, just 1.5 over 10 years, that's 15%, right?
Sure.
So imagine with compounding, that actually goes up to 20-odd%. So you just need to, and that's of your total amount that you are actually saving up. So you just want to be really careful. And I mean, just type in ChatGPT, long-term impact of a 1, 2, 3%, and it'll show you a graph that will scare you. Again, like I said, to be fair, it is based on the return. So sometimes the returns are high enough to justify that. Mm. But again, you need to be very careful.
Very careful. Yeah. And for our viewers at home, AI is not a financial service provider. So use it at your peril or at your advantage. I happen to be an AI enthusiast, but I know that you also have to be very careful with that kind of information and making sure that it is interpreted properly. But you touched on something interesting around these disclosures and, you know, entities being obligated to give you that table. Is there any kind of recourse if they sort of put it in a vague way, or they leave out some of the information or the impact over time? Is there anything that you can do, you know, just to protect our investors as well?
That's a tough question, and I really feel for a lot of investors because these contracts are ironclad. You know, I used to say to investors, you need a lawyer to read through these contracts. So they have covered themselves quite a bit. I used to say, that you need a lawyer to interpret these questions until I actually came across an investor who was a lawyer and also got caught out. So even being a lawyer is not going to really save you in that instance. So that's why knowing how to ask for fees, EAC, and being able to interpret it and understanding the long-term consequence, just by knowing that, that is going to protect you up front. Up until now, you're just going to have to call that school fees. You live and you learn, right?
You live and you learn.
But it is really difficult. You can try. If you feel there's something untoward, you can go to the ombudsman, right? And, you know, report your case. But I rarely see it being overturned because, unfortunately, these contracts, they are quite ironclad.
Just having the presence of mind to ask as well, looking at that table, like you said, shopping around where you can, knowing what the numbers generally look like, educating yourself, I think already you're a little bit more empowered than the next person.
Well, I mean, like as you, obviously we've been dancing around AI and the research and all that. So a lot of this information that we're talking about, it's available online. And you can use all the different applications, AI applications, to sort of complement your research. So I'm glad what you said a little bit earlier, where you said, look, you know, these aren't official financial advisor tools, you know. And, you know, if you look back a couple months ago, there's a reason why now when you type in, you know, ChatGPT and Claude all come back to you and say, bear in mind, this does not constitute financial advice.
Absolutely.
Because unfortunately, the models are still being trained and it's not quite 100% accurate. I've adopted it into my daily life in terms of using it for work, because it can actually make your life a lot quicker and more efficient, right? But I do find myself also continuously correcting and going, oh, that's not. So I'm more a double checker now, actually. And that's why the interaction with investors has been really fascinating, because I've seen sometimes they'll come with great authority from obviously using ChatGPT and just accepting what it says as like the law. And then I have to sort of, please share with me your info. Then I'll see, oh, actually you prompted it incorrectly, or you missed a variable, or. So there's lots of different ways that can actually sort of come undone. So the best way I can sort of help explain how to use AI is to complement with your research, to just help you understand things, concepts and that. Chatting to consultants, they're going to obviously give you knowledge. You can take down your notes and then you can go and fact check the individual. Now you have somebody that's actually trying to also protect you a little bit. And I really appreciate people using AI, because many times when I'm conversing with investors, they'll come to me and they were told something that's completely not factual. I'm like, where did you get this? No, I spoke to this financial person or that person. And this is where I can come in and just sort of help a person go, no, that was an opinion, not a fact. So, and I'm only one person. I can't, you know, help everyone with that. So it's really nice that they can come in and it's, I think the mistake is just obviously just accepting it.
As it is.
Yeah. The when I was studying CFA, there's a specific financial calculator, completely different to your normal calculator. And it's basically, it can do anything financial, like amortization tables, 30, 40 years. And it's a very complex machinery. But the problem is, if I were to put this calculator into a layman's hands, you won't even be able to do 1 plus 1.
Yeah.
Because of the way that the calculator is built, you have to do variables, then action, then equal, and then get it. So just the way that it is, and that's AI for you. It, you need to be able to know how to use it.
100%.
So that you don't make mistakes, that you don't land up getting the wrong answers. Yeah. You obviously mentioned that you obviously enthusiastic about your personal finance. And that you use it. How do you find it from like your side?
So I like to use it as a thinking partner. You know, I'd like to say, okay, I'm thinking of doing X, Y, and Z. Do you think that would be a prudent thing to do? Why not? Or yes. Rather than putting it and asking it for an answer and then running with it. So it's like you said, get your own information. Then I have this machine that I can sort of run it past and it will sort of be like, no, you're way off track, or so you're sort of coming back on the right track. And yeah, I'll ask it for financial advice and say, oh, well, look at, you know, the geopolitics. What would you be investing in right now, AI? And it will tell me. But I definitely am not at a place where I would just take that information and then run with it. I definitely want to run it past a warm body first.
Yeah.
And speaking of tools as well, so what are some of the more credible tools that people can then use to do these kinds of calculations?
Yeah, so, I mean, look, you can go online. Okay. AI, great tool you can also use.
With caution.
Yeah, yeah. But then you also, there's lots of financial tools and calculators available at the various investment houses, right?
Okay, so it's better to go to, like, the actual house and maybe use something on their website. Because from someone you trust, so you'd think, you know, it's not going to mislead you too much.
Well, yes, yeah. I'd be careful, though, because I've seen some calculators that omit very important variables. So, like, sometimes I see investment houses that have high fees and they take that variable out of the equation because they don't want you to see the drop-off over time. So, yeah, yeah. And I mean, I know I'm wearing a 10X hat here, right? But really, like, the 10X calculators, we really tried to make this as realistic as possible. I often look, I always say to the developers, I say, you know, your calculator looks so simple on the surface, but actually it's super, there's so much going on in the back end. And it's all about just incorporating realistic assumptions. You know, a calculator's output is only as good as its inputs. And that includes considering inflation, right? Including the negative impact of fees, market volatility. A lot of the time people will just assume a return of, let's say, 16% per annum. Now, you're not guaranteed to get 16% per annum for 20 years. You know, if you're just taking the past 10 years, on average, a balanced fund has gotten something like around 10%. Around there per annum, that's way off the 16%.
Absolutely.
So the realistic assumption of the return is very important to calculate with the calculation. And then obviously including how much you're contributing, which is not always straight line and increasing with inflation as well. When you're contributing towards retirement savings, you're getting a tax return. If you reinvest that, what does that look like? So all these different variables can actually impact the end result.
Mm.
And that's kind of what we really try to do with our calculators, just to help. And it's very user-friendly. You plug in your details and your variables, and we've actually used realistic assumptions for different market scenarios as well as inflation, including negative impact or fees, just so that you get a real number. Because I can't tell you how many times I'll chat to a 60-year-old that's 5 years out from retirement, and they'll even send me the quote that they received 20, 30 years ago, and they'll say, I don't understand, I'm so far off from my result.
Yeah.
They said I was going to have 10 million, I'm now on, let's say, 5 million.
Mm.
And I take a look at the quote and I see the assumption was not realistic, the fees weren't included, and that's why they're so far off. You can obviously receive your calculation, you can fact check it with AI, you can converse with people. Just try and chat to multiple investment houses as well, just so that you're getting perspective on it. Because sometimes an investment house isn't giving you all the facts. Mm. They're only giving you opinions.
Right. And that brings me to my next question. Who do you trust to give you an objective view? So you've run your numbers. You've got an idea of what your goal is, what you want to achieve. You've done the calculator input, and now you need to make a decision. So where do you get the support to now take the leap?
That's a very difficult question to ask, and I don't even think I can, because look, at the end of the day, there's lots of resources out there for you to help.
Yeah,
to help you with your decision. Right, you have lots of financial advisors available to you. You have lots of investment consultants, representatives, you know, friends, family, online tools, AI applications that you can use. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of them are going to act in your best interest, which is why you want to be able to spread it out.
Mm-hmm.
Right. At 10X, the way that our model works, we encourage investors to go direct, to try and cut down your, you know, bring down your fees, you know, minimize your costs to try and maximize your net return.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're maximizing your net return, you can, that can compound and you can grow your capital. The problem, though, is every now and then, you know, you don't understand one or two concepts, right? Or you're not, your research isn't, it's complete. There's a lot of articles all online, right? So that's why with 10X, to sort of help investors, you can actually go to the 10X website and you can actually click contact me.
Okay.
And then you have investment consultants like myself and a few of other of my colleagues who just act as a resource, you know, where we just try to help give you knowledge, help give you the facts, you know, on how things work.
Okay. Sounds very helpful. Okay, in closing, I think if you could leave us with two thoughts. What do you think should be the mindset shift that takes place after, you know, people have listened to this podcast and they've heard it? What is the mindset shift, and what is the one thing that you wish people would keep in mind when they change their jobs?
Yeah, I think the one thing that I really would encourage investors, and I always say this, finance should be taught in schools, 100%. Because everyone deals with it. And I understand that there's lots of people in different stages of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
If you're young, please start now learning. I mean, this is going to determine your financial independence. And I know finance can be boring. I know a lot of people setting this podcast to 2X, you know, to, I understand that. I'm aware of that. I've been to many parties where I'm talking about finance and see the glaze in people's eyes. So I know. But unfortunately, it is one of those things that you just need to take a little bit of ownership with, even if it's just the basics, you know, to get you started and get you moving in the right direction. Because if you don't, move in the right direction, then many years from now you're going to find yourself stuck. There's also types of investors where they are stuck and they think it's too late, and what you have is financial fatigue, where now they just feel like they give up. They don't feel like any decision they make is going to make any meaningful change. That's not true.
Mm-hmm.
I promise you, start.
Yeah.
Learn. And now, especially now, there's so much information. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can even chat to ChatGPT and say, explain it as if I'm a five-year-old,
yeah,
you know.
And it'll do that.
So if you feel intimidated, you can bring that information down to your level, right? And then when it comes to preserving your funds, hopefully this podcast actually helped sort of explain what your options are, and that you can weigh up what's the right call for you. Really, especially with the cash out, just be very wary and understand the short and long term. If you're unsure about things, you're more than welcome to reach out and we'll be able to assist.
About it. Awesome. Yeah, I think the key takeaways for me have been, we'll know and understand the vehicles that exist and where they can go. Know what your money's in and, you know, what you're sort of investing in. And then the fees. I really think people sleep on those fees, which can have devastating effects in certain instances, especially if you've tended to go on that higher side as we spoke about.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
What is, like, for you personally, right, what's your, like, number one concern when it comes to investing?
My number one concern, I think because I want to maximize and leverage as much as I can, you know, being a young investor. So I always want to know that I'm in the best possible fund. I'm reviewing it as much as possible because I don't want to be sitting next to Jack and we started with the same amount of money and the same amount of time and, you know, I got left behind. So maximizing returns. I know it sounds one track minded, but for me that is really important, to get the maximum benefit and have the information available that I did the best that I could, paid the least fees that I could, and yeah.
So you know what the fascinating thing about that concern is it's never going to go away. It's never going to go away. And I'll explain why, because every year there is something that happens in your life that you need to pivot and adjust. And all of a sudden, your financial plan needs to pivot and adjust. You're always constantly learning new things, new ways to optimize and sort of, all right, I can get a 0.5% out here and a 1% there. And that's just a continuous thing. I mean, I've been dealing with my own personal finances for years. And still, even this year, figuring out different ways to optimize here.
Yes.
And it's often based on, you know, certain events arise on the markets or laws and rules are changed and opens up opportunities. So there's all these different scenarios that could be presented year in, year out, month in, month out. And then you need to make a decision based on that. So it's not really addressing your concern or taking it away for you, but it's just to say, look, that's for everyone. So you shouldn't be worried about it. You should actually embrace it and go, okay, this is just something that needs to be continuously looked after.
Exactly. Yeah. It reminds me kind of like your personal or professional growth. You never just go and, you know, study something and say, okay, well, now I'm an expert. I know everything.
Yeah.
I can do any job. You know, you have to constantly go back. And I think even with your finances, you know, people will think, okay, now I've spoken to whoever I need to, you know, once a year or every 5 years, and I can just put it back in the cupboard and move on. Whereas it is continuous, just like everything is continuous. It's continuous growth, continuous learning. And yeah, taking control, I guess, of your money and not relegating it to a previous employer or even an advisor, but really just taking an interest in your finances.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, and speaking from a woman's perspective, I mean, you know, when you go hang out with the girls and all that, it must be difficult to talk about finance. I mean, okay. No, it's just because it's something that I've picked up on is, I mean, my wife, obviously I've like imparted quite a lot of information and knowledge on her, and it's been very interesting to see her interact with her friends. I was just wondering what it's like for you in interacting on that. So, like, because guys, they constantly talk at the Briar about this kind of stuff. But
It's interesting. I'm actually the finance person in our marriage because I'm so interested in it. So, I'll make the decisions of sort of who we're speaking to and how are we readjusting? Are we, you know, going in a bit harder here or slowing down there? I've got two daughters as well, and I'm very excited, you know, for them to also learn about this as early as possible. Because like you said, it's not taught in schools. And I think if you don't have that solid foundation, even from a young age, you sort of think your finances are somebody else's responsibility. So, I wear the hat. I'm sure I bore my husband with all the ETF talk and the unit trust talk, and he's just like, listen, you just tell me where I need to put it. And I'm like, I've got you.
I love that. I love that.
Yeah.
That's really nice.
This was a lovely, lovely discussion. Thank you so much, Michael. I hope our viewers have enjoyed it as well. And yeah, it's a strong reminder to take control, grab the bull by its horns and make those decisions. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Thank you.